The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join Brian Curtis and myself for the stories making news and moving markets in the APAC region. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcast and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Well, the European Union has opened a new probe into TikTok's parent company, ByteDance. Bloomberg's Joanne Wong has more from Hong Kong.
The EU is looking into whether the new TikTok Lite app has violated a new content law. The app promises to pay users through a point system. The European Commission said that might have an addictive effect on users. TikTok was given 24 hours to deliver a risk assessment to the Commission. Otherwise, the app could be fined up to 1% of its total annual income. The EU also said it plans to order TikTok to suspend the app's reward system until the feature can be fully assessed. In Hong Kong, Joanne Wong, Bloomberg Radio.
And joining us now for further discussion on this is Alex Barinka, Bloomberg tech reporter, taking a closer look. So, Alex, the EU wants TikTok Lite to do a proper risk assessment. That sounds pretty reasonable. But on the other hand, the EU is critical that users can be rewarded through a point system because that might have an addictive effect on them. Now, some might say that's overreach, but I'm sure it's more nuanced than that. Walk us through it.
It certainly is. And so the EU has given the company 24 hours on this risk assessment or risk fines up to 1% of its annual income. And the kind of regulations over there have been much more protective, we'll say, over its users than in other countries like in the US. It's not the first time that the EU has gotten involved looking at the app's addictive design, looking at screen time limits and privacy settings. It's been scrutinizing and investigating TikTok under the Digital Services Act on its main TikTok app. So under the umbrella of ByteDance, whether it's TikTok or this new TikTok Lite app that pays users through a point system, it does seem that the European Commission is being a lot more thoughtful about what it allows tech giants to introduce to its users within the block and making sure that they won't have a negative effect on the citizens there.
Big question mark over the future of this company with passage over the weekend of the House bill. As you know, Alex, I mean, you either divest control of TikTok, and I'm talking here about the Chinese parent ByteDance, or face a ban in the U.S. Now, today, the company's essentially saying it will fight this measure in court. Do you think they have a legal leg to stand on?
They will certainly try. So as you mentioned, this is the U.S. divest or ban bill that flew through the House on Saturday, tied up with the Ukraine-Israel aid bill. And it's expected to get a vote in the Senate as soon as this week, could be as soon as tomorrow, with President Joe Biden saying he would sign it immediately. Now, ByteDance has said, according to a person familiar with the matter, that it expects it could get a restraining order that could kind of draw out this legal battle to more than a year. We have reported in the past that any kind of divestiture, the company sees it as the absolute last resort. So hearing that now with this bill almost an inevitability in its passage, that they're looking at their legal options, isn't so much of a surprise. What has been a surprise to me, frankly, is in the last week, they've been relatively quiet. We've seen folks like their VP of policy, Michael Beckerman, give interviews to TikTokers, talking to the TikTok audience. We've seen kind of small communications from them, but this does mean that the first kind of big wave of getting TikTok's official public point of view might actually be around some of these legal arguments they make if this bill does get signed into law as soon as this week.
To what degree is TikTok in the United States really amping up, muscling up on its lobbying?
It has been muscling up quite a lot. So last year was its biggest year on record for lobbying in the United States. And it's an interesting distinction with TikTok. TikTok actually doesn't file lobbying documents. It's ByteDance that's doing all the lobbying on behalf of them. We just got the new numbers for TikTok's parent ByteDance, and it said that they spent $2.7 million in the first quarter of this year. That's up from $1.6 million in the same period in 2023. So you can see that they are kind of muscling up their lobbying effort and have been. Now, if you're a person like me who's been watching the progression of bills and legislation against TikTok working its way through, now we're sitting here on the eve of one of those bills actually passing, you do have to ask, how much are these high-powered lobbyists actually having an effect in D.C.? Folks who are watching the passes of this bill kind of looming might say not as much as they might hope.
You know, I understand the being compelled to try to fight it in court, but if you look at the 2017 national intelligence law in China, it's pretty clear there's a legal obligation for Chinese companies to turn over data collected abroad and domestically. This just fortifies the U.S. position that this is a national security issue. One of the questions that I was wondering about is whether or not the Chinese government could use the TikTok issue as a way of negotiating what it would like to get from the U.S. government in any way. Do you think that's possible?
I mean, when this bill passed last week, when it was introduced last week that the House was going to do this in this aid package, that news was quickly overshadowed by President Joe Biden having some kind of strong words against China in a meeting just a few hours later. So I wouldn't be surprised if this gets tied up in this kind of back and forth discourse or tension. We do know that Beijing, the Chinese government, would stand in the way of any kind of divestiture. Divestiture of TikTok from ByteDance would require approval from Chinese regulators. And a person familiar with the matter told us in just the last 24 hours, the government in China has made it clear it wants neither TikTok's prized algorithm or that really valuable data to fall into Americans' hands. So certainly this is kind of another point of potential tension when it comes to the back and forth between Washington and Beijing.
Yeah, this is certainly going to be with us for a while. If I had to take the over-under on 10 discussions with you over the next year on this, I'd probably take the over. I wanted to go back to the European Union story because we know that TikTok is planning to fight in the United States. And this is pretty new, this new set of restrictions that the EU is putting on ByteDance and TikTok. But in some ways, it highlights the real difference between the systems in the West and in China. Because one of the things that the EU is complaining about with this is that it's really like almost paying users to watch videos and run up the numbers of TikTok. And that seems kind of weird or wrong or, you know, something. But it's a little bit like Baidu. I mean, Baidu actually rewards those companies that want their searches to come in high. Those companies are willing to pay for it. So it really does highlight the difference between the systems. And I wonder whether or not, you know, there's a place for TikTok in a place like the European Union, which is heavy on the regulation side anyway.
In my industry, or folks in the industry that I cover, we call it the attention economy, right? Where the actual kind of value that these companies are getting out of you is your attention. So certainly, as you know, TikTok has really changed the game in the social media industry, where it's not about who you follow. It's about showing you things that you're interested in with almost an addictive quality of keeping you in the app for a longer and longer time. So as the EU kind of grapples with TikTok, I would also think it's a decent argument to make that you would have to look at YouTube Shorts or Instagram Reels or Facebook Reels along the same lines, because some of the kind of core of how those apps work have been, you know, lifted from TikTok and are kind of striving to do the same thing of keeping you there, keeping you scrolling, keeping your attention for longer and longer, because that's where they find value both in the app and for the advertisers that are willing to pay for your eyeballs.
We have to remember this is a monster company. The parent ByteDance, I think, it's privately held, valuation of around $268 billion. I think TikTok's U.S. business is closer to between 40 and 50 billion in valuation. Alex, always a pleasure. Thanks for making time to chat with us. Alex Barinka, Bloomberg tech reporter, talking today about TikTok.
Pamela Ambler, APAC Investor Intelligence Head at JLL. Pamela, thank you very much for joining the program. I think one question on a lot of people's minds, really across the region, is when we might see a little bit of progress on getting a handle on China's property market. Do you see that anytime this year?
Yeah, well, when it comes to China from the capital market standpoint, we are already beginning to see activity picking up from before. So just looking at our Q1 numbers, it is a decline of roughly 20% year over year. But when you look at what has been the active capital sources, it's not only the local developers and foreign investors that have been offloading assets at a discount. Insurers are also looking for opportunities to make acquisitions, taking advantage of those dislocated pricing.
So I'm curious as to whether or not in everything that you're looking at, that there is opportunity, whether it's in commercial real estate or any sector of the market that has been so badly beaten down, so ignored, whether you're finding potential opportunity.
Yeah, well, if you think about investors, their thoughts around the stock market that people are the most familiar with, the buying opportunity is always when there is a pricing dislocation, when there is value to be found in the market. And similarly, in commercial real estate, it is the same situation. People are not looking to act until they believe that prices or valuations is bottoming. The difference is when it comes to public markets, you're talking about being able to mark to market. And so to identify a bottom in pricing is easier than a less liquid market like commercial real estate. But in reality, because of what we're seeing in terms of the trades that have taken place, especially in Q4 and Q1, it's giving investors new benchmarks to look at for pricing. And that's going to compel investors to then act.
One of the dislocations probably can be seen, I would imagine, on of Hong Kong property and the fact that the economy has struggled really of late because of what's happening in China and because of the pandemic at a time when U.S. interest rates were high. And because of the fixed exchange link, you had high interest rates here in that kind of environment. At some point, that changes. Do you think that when that happens, when the Fed finally starts cutting interest rates, that it will sort of be when the sun comes out for Hong Kong property, or do you think that that ship has already sailed?
Well, absolutely. Hong Kong is one of the markets that time and time again, they have gone through challenges and come out the other side in a very resilient manner. They have proven that they can bounce back. It's happened before in the Asian financial crisis. It's happened after SARS. It's happened, of course, with COVID, where we saw a surge in, for hotels, for example, RevPAR, a jump in terms of the demand. And also we're seeing that from the retail standpoint. So sure, it's most likely that this time around, it's taking a bit longer than expected, because as you mentioned, China's recovery is also slower than expected. But the situation with Hong Kong also is that connection with the mainland really allows it to have a very, very unique position. It is basically the market where capital can access essentially one of the world's largest economies.
We were just talking about the problems with the shadow banking industry in South Korea, particularly as it relates to real estate. And I'm wondering, in this conversation, by the way, there was the issue of the government really monitoring the situation and stepping in. We have seen a very, very reluctant Chinese response to the problems with the property sector. Maybe a little begrudgingly, they have made, some adjustments around the edges. But I think there's been this belief that leadership wants to deflate this bubble in an orderly way. Is it progressing in an orderly way still, or do you feel that there is some risk that maybe still in the system that could be very damaging?
Absolutely. And I think this is a really important question. The reason why I think a lot of investors and market watchers are waiting for the PBOC to take more action, and they are not, is you got to look at the bigger picture, which is the global macro situation. So we have the Fed, which, you know, at one point at the beginning of the year, we're talking about quite aggressive rate cuts, which has almost reversed itself in terms of that narrative and what markets are pricing in. So, of course, the PBOC is looking at that very carefully, because when you look at policy divergence, historically speaking, that has created large amounts of capital outflow from China. China does not want that to happen. And to protect its economy and to grow its economy, it has to be very thoughtful about the stimulus and in which it provides to support the economy, because you're looking at multiple factors to propel investments. And another consideration is, of course, there are, as you mentioned, thoughtful actions taken by the government, whether that is asking slightly more well-capitalized insurers to step in to support the developers through this challenging period of time. So there are multiple prongs, I believe, the government is utilizing.
Pamela Ambler, APAC Intelligence, Investor Intelligence Head at JLL.
Well, there are signs of stress building in South Korea's shadow banking industry. Delinquency rates, as one measure for a key group of Korean banks right now, is nearly double what it was last year at around 6.5%. Let's take a closer look now with Finbar Flynn, Bloomberg's Asia Credit Markets Editor, who joins us from the Japanese capital. Finbar, thank you so much for making time with us. How much of this is actually a direct exposure to real estate when we talk about the extent to which the shadow banking industry in South Korea has grown so dramatically?
Good morning. Thank you. It actually is all real estate. It comes down to real estate all across the board. Because like in many markets, when cash was cheap and interest rates were low, these highly levered bets, and they're especially highly levered in Korea based on how they actually fund these deals, people poured into them. And when rates went up, things started to give.
So in the old days, we referred to shadow banking a lot in China. It was very much considered a negative. And now it's called private credit, and it seems to have a much better reputation in the West. But one thing that runs through all of this can be liquidity issues, correct?
There's no doubt about that. And I like the point about the difference between shadow banking and private credit. In Korea, it is basically these smaller financial institutions, smaller savings banks, smaller securities companies who've taken on most of this debt. It looked like a good idea at the time, but Korea has a history of these repeated sort of bubbles in its commercial property sector, and people are looking out for more headlines in the second half.
So what does this mean for systemic risk in the financial system right now in South Korea?
So basically, the government in South Korea is throwing everything at this. They're going in there, they're buying property, they're putting up guarantees against existing loans.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
And new loans. So what is the sort of the down case scenario? The down case scenario is that we have more restructurings, and it could cause the Bank of Korea to cut more than it has signaled this year. It could cause the government to pour money into it. So this has broad systemic implications, because about a third to four-tenths of the entire economy is in this.
Finbar, is there a lesson here for other jurisdictions in Asia? I mean, is this an issue that's likely to be repeated in other countries?
I certainly think there is, and I would say it's beyond Asia, because we've seen the creaks and the cracks in property from New York to Los Angeles to Berlin to London. So there are lots of places that have these issues, but they're just the Bank of Korea hiked quicker. So they're facing these issues probably a little bit earlier.
I'm wondering whether the regulators in South Korea fear worst case scenarios, something like what Japan went through 30 years ago, where you have bank failures, that it's just more than a couple of small banks that have problems, you know, and stress that may be building on their balance sheets, whether there is a real risk of bank failures at scale. Is that a distinct possibility?
Well, the good news, there is good news. The good news is that the bigger banks, they are very well capitalized, the top four or five banks. So in terms of the bigger banks, the actual scenario more likely is that they'll be buying up the smaller banks. That's not to say that the government doesn't have to be very careful, because it's not just the commercial property. South Korea has the most housing debt per capita almost of any country in the world. So they cannot allow these two things to meld together, which would be really systemic.
So what can you tell us about some of the restructurings that we've seen, both successful and unsuccessful, and what the message to be drawn is?
So we have one key case going on. And to be honest, this is still, I would say, in its early stages. We just had the election in South Korea. People had expected things to be, you know, kept on board in the first few months of the year, and then for the government and authorities to become a little bit more stringent in the second half. But we have a company called Taeyong. They surprised markets at the end of 2023 when they said they needed to restructure debt. They're a large mid-sized lender, construction company, and they have a vote at the end of this month. And that will basically mean that lenders have to take an equity swap of 50% of their debt. So they'll be taking 50% equity for their debt. So they'll be basically taking a cut, and then the rest of the 50 will all depend if the company can pay it back. But interestingly, people said this company, Taeyong, it may be the first, but it's not the last.
It's kind of staggering when you look at the numbers. I'm bringing up data on overall GDP for South Korea in dollar terms. The latest data that I have is for 2022, $1.67 trillion. And we're talking about $671 billion worth right now of exposure to this debt in real estate alone. I mean, when you consider the amount of money relative to annual GDP, it's an amazing figure.
It is. It's an astounding figure. And the only upside is, I think, and this is a good thing for the South Korean economy, is they obviously are a huge exporter. So they're a huge beneficiary of the AI, whole trend. So the economy, that could lift the economy sufficiently so they don't have to suffer too much. But it's a really difficult balancing act they have in the next couple of months.
No doubt about it. And Finbar, thank you so much for joining us and helping us bring a little clarity to the story on the signs of stress building in the shadow banking industry in South Korea. Finbar Flynn, a Bloomberg Asia Credit Markets editor, joining us from our studios in Tokyo here on Daybreak Asia.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.